Here comes the Sweet Pickles bus.
Smart moms know how kids' minds grow upon Sweet Pickles.
Your child's head start for school starts with this free Sweet Pickles preschool bus. There are stickers, games, puzzles, and hours of fun inside. They'll make learning basic skills like numbers and letters seem like child's play to your 2 to 6-year-old. So they'll love to learn, honest.
I think it's
welcome, boys and girls. This is the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. What is the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, you may ask? Is it a wilderness cafe? No, it is not a coffee shop in the woods. It's a podcast.
A wilderness cafe? That would be really fun. You know, you're out cold hunting all day. You want a hot cup of cocoa. Where are you going to go? You're going to go to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
Mm-hmm. And afterwards, you're going to sit on the bear box. So, I take it you watched that deleted scene from The Dark Knight Rises I sent you?
Right. So Mike sends me the deleted Bane scene from The Dark Knight Rises, so I immediately click on it. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have to say I waited a few minutes to click on it. Mm-hmm. Had you, though, sent me what it really was and said, you must watch this Sweet Pickles commercial, I would have stopped what I was doing, mm-hmm. and I would have immediately done that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it ended up not being the deleted Bane scene, but was, in fact, Sweet Pickles.
Yeah.
Boy, did that bring back a rush of memories. The Sweet Pickles preschool bus commercial, which, I mean, is so ingrained in my subconscious from childhood. I think that commercial was on every day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It was heavily programmed, especially on the channels we watched, like Nickelodeon. It was heavily programmed.
Sweet Pickles and me. I mean, I used to sing that all the time. And I didn't realize until I was doing some reading on this that it was an award-winning commercial.
Uh-huh. So the reading that you did was in the description of the YouTube video I sent you. Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't do anything more than that. But I wanted to dive into it a little bit because I thought, well, how is that an award-winning commercial?
Right. Well, I think it's because it broke, like, records for, you know, the
sales?
Response, yeah, it did enormously well, but I did slightly more reading on the topic than you did. Ultimately, despite the fact that it was very profitable, the book series Sweet Pickles, and the campaign obviously was very, very effective, it was deemed to be, you know, kind of a flop in that it really the point of the books was to teach children the alphabet.
Right. There were 40 I remember there being 40 different books specifically. Right.
Yes.
And I think I had all of them.
Well, 26 of them each dealt with a letter of the alphabet. The lead character, like the accusing alligator in the A book, you know, they were all meant to kind of help preschool age kids. They were designed for 2 to 6-year-olds with the alphabet. The thing is, as educators kind of criticized it, is that they really weren't effective books for teaching the alphabet.
Isn't this the same sort of crap we're hearing from, like, Baby Einstein stuff now, which, in fact, the kids that end up watching Baby Einstein, they've found in tests, are actually learning less quickly than mm-hmm. kids who aren't watching Baby Einstein DVDs?
And it gives them asthma.
Yeah, I didn't realize that the Sweet Pickles books were read on various episodes of the Captain Kangaroo show.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. So even though it did really well, you know, it sort of didn't do what it was supposed to do, at least in the opinion of some educators. But the reason this has come back into the sphere, incidentally, I'm not making this up. Do you know what the name of the character is in the X book?
Only because I'm looking at it now, I wouldn't have known. Xerus?
Yeah, but do you know the full name? Like, the alligator in A is the accusing alligator. Do you know the name of what his full name is in the X book?
I wanted to say, like, Yakety Yak or something, but that was Yakety Yak, Yak, Yak. That was the Y. No, mm-hmm. Xerus, that's all I know.
Mm. It really is X-rated Xerus. It is a book for preschool children. And I'm not going to tell you any more than that. I want you to go and find out more about X-rated Xerus on your own. But if Sweet Pickles generates warm and fuzzies for you, you'll be delighted to know that the series has now been released as an all of them as ebooks that you can put on your tablet device and share. You don't have to wait for the bus to come. Now, I will say this.
How did that bus work, right? The bus, like, pulled into your town and it was like an ice cream truck, and the kids could go outside, and if the Sweet Pickles bus was there and all the animals were stuffed animals were in the back of the bus, you could go out and buy like a lunchbox full of books. Is that how that thing worked?
Well,
it was really hard to scale. That was your business model.
You were watching too much Shark Tank. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't like...
They're like, that's not going to fly. You're going to have a bus in every town driving right. around?
Yeah, Mark Cuban would just kind of sit back and be like, I'm out.
Right.
Certainly from the commercial, and I think children like us that watched it in our youth thought that there was like a dedicated Sweet Pickles bus, like UPS has a dedicated truck that comes and delivers these book packs to you, as the commercial says, you know, once every 4 weeks. Not true. Your mailman brought Sweet Pickles. But the commercial led you to believe that there were like these mascot-like characters, you know, like in costumes, like, you know, whatever that is at the beginning of the commercial. Is it a duck or whatever it is? I don't even remember. That like presents the child with the first Sweet Pickles package.
I think it was like the elephant, right? Enormous elephant?
I don't know. Whatever you thought, though, based on that commercial, you were really in for some disappointment when the first one came.
No, because it was the goose. I wanted
the goose.
I wanted the goose to come to my house. And I remember being disappointed as a kid when we got them. Like, I thought that they were going to come and deliver them in the bus.
Mm-hmm. I think all kids thought that based on the way the commercial was presented. But, of course, that wasn't the case. Your mailman brought them. And thus the disappointment began there. But they had you by then. They'd already gotten what was the introductory package? Like $3.49 was what you paid?
Right. Yeah,
like, can you imagine? That wouldn't even cover the cost of priority shipping.
Today, right.
Like, yeah. Priority shipping starts at $5.35 a box.
So what's interesting about this, you know, you would get the lunch pail, which mm-hmm. you really wouldn't want to use it as a lunch pail, right? You'd use it to hold the books.
Yes.
And it was weird because when you started to fill the lunch pail up, I don't know what designer figured this out or thought this out, but you couldn't hold all 40 books in it. Mm-hmm. This weird bento box that was holding the whole thing together, right? You couldn't actually use it to hold all of the books. So you had to, you know, you had to only put like a certain selection of books in there. Or maybe they just assumed you would never buy all the books, so it wouldn't fit in this lunchbox. I don't know.
You'd get X-rated Zerus and you'd be like, I think we're out.
Right. What a hard letter to teach to a kid, though. I think it's interesting, though, that, like you said, this research has shown that they weren't terribly effective for kids in teaching mm-hmm. them the alphabet. I guess – so the books didn't teach the alphabet like the alphabet series of today, which would feature words throughout the story beginning with that respective letter. So I guess these books just
– they just had a character whose name started with a letter, and that was really all the more that they got around to. They were like, good luck, kids. You know, and now certainly the children in the commercial – I have a funny feeling they may have been paid. They may have been paid for their endorsements, those kids. They really seemed positive about it, but I don't know.
Have they been reimagined in any kind of a way to be more effective for today's learning? Now I see that from these e-books, at least the 26 books, they're digitally enhanced. So they've got professional sound effects, narration, and character voices, they've chosen some award-winning voice actors,
mm-hmm.
but still, it doesn't change the content, right?
I would guess not.
I mean, it still doesn't change that they're not effective. So, because I got excited when I was thinking about this as ebooks, I'd buy a few of these for my son and daughter. But mm-hmm. now, I mean, there's far more effective things out there. Like some of the Elmo books and things are far more effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like my son knows his alphabet already. You know, mm-hmm. from some of the stuff we've had, like on iPad and other things. Like, he already knows.
At least A through G. He's really good at those.
No, he can sing the entire alphabet. He can point to different letters. He knows, like, all of the different letters. Now, he doesn't know how to read, right? He can't read, like, certain – he can't read words, but he knows the letters. He can see the different letters and things. But, you know, it is interesting that the – even, I think, in the Malcolm Gladwell book that we read, right, The Tipping Point –
mm-hmm. Yes.
And there's that discussion of Sesame Street and how they found Blue's Clues. I mean, it was a great section of that book, right, and how they found Blue's Clues to be far more effective.
Right, yeah. He uses the term sticky.
Right. But I think these were sticky for me, the Sweet Pickles books. I mean, I always loved having them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, and yeah, the campaign was really, really effective. Now, when I found that commercial, YouTube then suggested some other things. And one of the things it found for me was one of the original bumpers that Nickelodeon used to air at the top of every hour. And I had not watched one of these probably in 25 years. And I kind of remember those sorts of things finally. I don't think they exist anymore. You know, it was like this animated thing of, it was kind of crazy. And it was like an announcer telling you what was coming up. You know, like, up next, this hour on Nickelodeon, Dennis the Menace, and then the Monkees, you know, or whatever. And those things don't really exist anymore. I was thinking of that the other day. For some strange reason, my son wanted to watch G.I. Joe. I think the reason for this is because the comic book store that he and I frequent, in the window, they're always playing an episode of G.I. Joe. Always. Always. So whenever we walk up, he's like, Daddy, what's that? I say, G.I. Joe. So I think that's why that's in his head. So he said, I want to watch G.I. Joe, and I had some G.I. Joe on DVD, so I said, sure. And we would put it in, and I'm sure you remember this, not that it sticks out in your mind, but the moment I refresh it, going out of, back and forth into commercial breaks, there's this other screen, which I call a bumper. Now, you work in television, so maybe you'll tell me what it's called these days, but I think of it as a bumper, where they said, you know, G.I. Joe will return in a moment. You know, and it's like the G.I. Joe logos on the screen, or like Mask used to have that as well. You know, Mask will be back in a moment, and Venom too. You know, that sort of thing. I think of that as a bumper. Is that the right term?
Mostly bumper is, well, I don't know. I mean, mostly a bumper is used in radio parlance. So you know, they'd have those like choo choo. Or we have a bumper here on the Grizz. You know, it's the Super Friends transition.
Right. Okay.
The bumper. So. Yeah, I don't know. Like, we use but you'd say in television, like, we're going to bump to break with, like, a shot of the city or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess, perhaps. I don't know that there's any sort of hard and fast rule for it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. It was an interesting slice right out of 1986 to watch these original Nickelodeon bumpers.
Yeah, they had some of that when we were at the Monkees concert, right? They had some of those bumpers up on the screen going into break for the Monkees television show. Like, more of the Monkees after this. And they showed some old commercials during the concert, or leading into the concert, I should say.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, they famously were contracted for a couple years. They did endorsements for Kellogg's brand cereals. I think it was the last actual day he was a Monkee before he was liberated from his contract that Nez had to do a Kool-Aid commercial. And he wears this like crazy sparkly white cowboy hat that he used to have. And I remember seeing a picture in like one of the books I have about them where he has the most sour expression on his face that you've ever seen. Like, it's like him pouring Kool-Aid in this cowboy hat. contractually they were all, you know, tied to those kinds of endorsement things, and they had to wear clothes that were from JCPenney. Like, they, you know, every bit of it was very carefully managed for them by all the guys behind it. Bob Rafelson and, Bert Schneider passed away a year or two ago, but he was one of the leading guys behind it as well, and the brain trust that made the Monkees what they were. So, some of this stuff kind of fell into my lap because of a tweet we got from a member of the Egghead Army, Chad Ingalls. I don't know if you saw this. But he sent us this weird website that was like, it's like a list of just outdated junk or whatever. And as I was scrolling down through it, I came across what they purport to be laser tag. Now, you and I had laser tag.
No, is this like photon tag? There was like a different one. Remember, there was like the cheesy, it was like the lesser one.
That's right. There was a knockoff. Much like GoBots were the infinitely inferior version of Transformers, laser tag, at least in the 80s, because this picture is not laser tag, the picture on this website, or it's like laser tag from 15 years after we had it. Laser tag had an infinitely inferior knockoff called Photon.
Photon.
You're exactly right.
Now, that's the one that I had. I was upset.
Oh, you had Photon.
Yeah, I was upset that I got Photon. Well, I think I had Photon, and I was upset about it, and then I ended up getting laser tag. Or maybe it just sort of fell out of favor. Because I don't know that it ever really worked anyway. I always felt like someone was pulling my leg.
What, with laser tag?
Yeah. Like, I don't know that I ever really felt like it worked. You know?
Like, do you remember, oh my God, what was the show where you shot at the TV screen? Do you know what I'm talking about? It was like a spaceship gun, and you'd shoot at the TV screen, and the conceit was that the show was shooting back at you. But of course you were just bouncing the beam off of the TV screen right back at yourself and hitting the thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Captain Power.
Captain
is what
Powell.
It was called.
Wow.
The first time I ever had to be in a hospital that I remember as a child, that was on in the waiting room. I was sitting there like in one of those surgical gowns, you know, where like your butt hangs out the back. And I was in the waiting room, like waiting to go in, and I just remember Captain Power was on TV.
And the Soldiers of the Future.
Oh my. Did you just look it up that quick?
Oh, I just looked it up, man.
I was like, wait, how do you remember that?
I remember the name of the show. I never remember whatever you call it, the mini line. What do you call it? Right. What would you call that?
They are the news to the Huey Lewis of Captain Power.
Right. So it was 1987 to 88. It only lasted one season, 22 episodes.
Yeah. And the gun was like a spaceship. You could play with it, but then when the show was on, the idea was that it was an interactive TV show, which was a lark, but I knew a lot of kids bought it. You know, and that was the thing, that you shot at the TV screen, and then you had the target. The target was on the jet, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but if you got hit three times, like the jets would eject the pilot.
The wings would, like, break off, wouldn't they?
I kind of remember that the thing was Captain Power would get ejected from the jet. Like, if you let him get hit too many times, they had, like, an eject mechanism in the ship, and it, like, fired him out. I could be wrong. This is a long time ago, and I never had it. But I do remember when it came out. That's how I felt. The way you felt about laser tag, I felt about Captain Power. I was like, something's not right about that.
Yeah, like, you never really believed that it was actually – I just didn't buy that it was actually happening. And you could – so the XT7 could interact with the live-action television show. But the game was only a VHS tape. So if you had the game, the missions played out the same way over time. And then these other interactive objects in the series called the Phantom Striker and the Interlocker Throne for Lord Dredd. There were like these station. I remember – because I remember the black one. And that was the Lord Dredd machine. It looked a lot like Cobra. I mean, it looked like a G.I. Joe ripoff too. But just like set in the future. But yeah, you would basically you would shoot this thing at an optional target viewer. It could be taken on and off, and you put the power on platform, which then could plug into Captain Power figure, and it could transform. Once it triggered on the screen, the base was fired up by one of the other vehicles. The toy would immediately trigger the power on sequence, causing the chest of the figure to glow. But I thought I remembered it like exploding, like the wings would fall off if it got hit a number of times.
You could be right.
But they have, you know, what's interesting, they have DVD releases of this.
So, of Captain Power.
Yeah. So in the recent DVD release, the series writer, Michael Straczynski, reveals that the planned end for the series was Lord Dredd learning of Overmind's hidden agenda and Lord Dredd teaming up with Captain Power to free all of humanity over Overmind.
And this is J. Michael Straczynski that wrote it?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
J. Michael Straczynski.
Wow. So, yeah, this bogus set of laser tag, which, yeah, Photon was – that was like – you know, I realize maybe this doesn't happen so much anymore. But in the 80s, there were like a series of consumer faux pas that your parents could make that kind of made you an outcast. For example, you had the Beta VCR in the neighborhood.
Right.
For people who don't understand, before VHS became – omnipresent, or ubiquitous perhaps is the better term, there was a rival, Beta. And if you were the one kid in the neighborhood that had a Beta VCR in your house, that meant you couldn't share tapes with anybody, they couldn't share tapes with you. You had the far smaller selection. Like, right. Beta never had the variety that VHS did. What else is kind of like akin to that? Definitely having Photon instead of laser tag was one of those things. Like, if you got one of those – this is a little bit later, but if you got one of those platforms that didn't last, like the Lynx or the TurboGrafx-16.
Well, I even think like ColecoVision, right? Like, if you got ColecoVision instead of Atari, although, I mean, ColecoVision was early on. I'm trying to remember. Was ColecoVision before I remember – I think my friend Ben had it.
You had a Coleco, didn't you?
No.
You had a 2600 maybe.
Right. I had ColecoVision was 1984. It was discontinued, but it came out in 1982 on the heels of. I remember it coming out on the heels of Atari, because it was at the 2100. It came out first, and then the 2600. I had the 2600, but we also had Pong in my house. I remember playing Pong when I was a kid, but it was on. I guess maybe the Atari 5200. But I do remember a couple of cool games like Cat and Mouse or Mousetrap. They had Mousetrap, and my friend Ben had and I used to love to play Mousetrap on those ROM cartridges. And they had Donkey Kong as well on there, which was weird for Nintendo because they didn't usually license out. If you think about it, you know, they never really license out their games. I mean, they keep them on their platform, right? You either have a Nintendo Wii and you can play all of their games, or you don't and you can't play any of their games. So they licensed out Donkey Kong to ColecoVision consoles. I wonder if they've ever done that before. It's the only time they've ever done that. I don't know if they've ever done that since.
I don't know. But so, yeah, as I was looking at this thing from Chad Ingalls here, a couple other kind of like, you know, morts like that came to mind. I forgot this even existed. You remember Sega Game Gear?
As
the Game Boy alternative?
Yeah.
No, refresh my memory because I have a vague recollection of this. I never had it. Wasn't Game Gear like the first one that was color?
I think it was the first one that was color. It was the first commercial. I mean, I remember it being like the first commercially available one. There were a couple of other like 8-bit processor things that never, like the Atari Lynx. Do you remember the Atari Lynx? So now I'm thinking about it. I think the Atari Lynx came out and it was color before the Game Gear. And there was another one called, yeah, I know there's another one. So no, it wasn't the first, but it was definitely one of the first. In the early 90s, because I'm trying to remember when the Game Boy came out. Was the Game Boy like 1989 or something?
Yeah, it had to be end of the 80s, right? It couldn't have been end of the 90s.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like 1989. And, of course, that was gray. And then, the Sega Game Gear came out. But there was the Atari Lynx that was out before that. I distinctly remember that. And I don't know how well that thing did but I remember I wanted one. It was weird. It kind of looked like almost looked like one of the PSP players, you know, it's like a large sort of black handheld device. But it was color, and it came out like right around the same time as the Game Boy, the original Game Boy. But no one bought it because everyone's like, oh, you know, Nintendo, the Game Boy, and all those cool Mario games. And that I think is an example of something coming along too quickly, right? I mean, here you have this color device, but it had crap games.
Yeah.
So you had the Atari Lynx, because I remember like Afterburner, but there was a game that was called like Blue Lightning, and it was kind of like Afterburner. Remember the jet game?
Yeah,
that you play, and but it only had a couple of crap games. It had like Breakout and Space Invaders in color, and then over on the Game Boy, yes, it was in black and white, but you had like Kid Icarus, the new Kid Icarus game. You had Super Mario Land, which was incredible. Do you remember playing the black and white version of Super Mario Land? That was a great game.
No, I don't remember that at all.
I mean, it was like a really good Super Mario Brothers game. And who cared that it was in black and white? You know, it didn't really matter. Just an example of like, yeah, they came out with this great platform and then they came out with no games for it. So people are like, I don't care about color. I'd rather just get the black and white Game Boy. Remember the batteries dying on that thing so quickly, though, you know?
Yes. I did not remember this. This was also on this list of things that Chad Ingalls sent to us. There was apparently a little camera that you could buy for the Game Boy that attached to a very small printer.
Really?
Yes. And
I don't remember
you could
that.
Print out little crappy black and white images, as crazy as that is.
Do you remember – I mean, I don't remember that, and that's fascinating to me. Because why would you – these peripherals that came out for these devices back then? I do remember – the only thing I remember was the nightlight. I remember the nightlight.
What?
There was like a screen that would flip up that you could put on top of the Game Boy. Do you remember that?
No.
It was called like the Game Boy Pocket or something. It was like a Game Boy light that you would put on top of it, and it flipped up almost like the type of thing you'd flip up to launch the nuclear missiles. You know what I mean? Like that little plastic, like a little plastic shield that would lift up over the big red button. But it had like a little LED light in it, and so you would strap it on the top of your Game Boy. And I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it used its own batteries because it was only battery powered. The Game Boy had four AA batteries, so there's no way it would draw more light from that thing. So you'd be using six AA batteries basically to play your Game Boy at night, and you'd go through it like in 5 hours, and you have to like buy new lights all the time.
It's like the battery on the first cell phone that I had. It was good for about 30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I just remember the Game Boy Light. It was like a little flip-down screen that would go over top of it, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if that's the proper name for it or not, but... oh, yeah, here, you just sent this to me. The Game Boy printer?
Right, look at that. Come on.
Is that for real?
Look at that. I have like a vague, you know, sort of... I don't think I ever knew anybody that had it, but...
So you'd strap on... So here's what it is. You're strapping on... It's a game. So you'd put the cartridge in the Game Boy called the Game Boy Camera. But all it is like a really terrible web camera, like you'd put on top of your computer. But the game is the web camera. So you attach the game into the back of the Game Boy like you're playing. But you're not even playing a game. All you're doing is just – and then the screen turns on. And you take a picture of yourself with the webcam, and then you've got this attached printer that prints out this like bitmapped, terrible looking matrix printer that prints out almost looks like a receipt printer. You know, like right. You have like a guy at a restaurant prints you.
Right,
out
it's
a
like that annoying. You know, it's too small, so it curls right up into a little ball the moment right. That they put it on the counter for you to sign. And like, oops, I'm sorry, I'll get that, and it rolls away.
Right,
like because man, I need that kind of functionality at home.
You know, it's the printer that the guy at the National Rental Car place has when you pull it back in to check the car back in, you know, and he gives you that little printout that's useless.
Mm. Hmm. I do know.
Well, man, this is quite the hookup here because you've got cords hooked up to this thing running into the back of this thing all for you to take some terrible black and white photo.
Right. Wow. Right. Look at the resolution on that, what's coming out of that printer. It's like what are those like photo booths at the mall? You put like a dollar in and you sit there and a quick takes three photos when you're not ready and then prints them out on a sheet. Like it's not even that quality. It really is. It's like I'm sure this is what it is. It's the same technology that like when you know you've got your first credit card machine at like a mom and pop shop. This is the receipt printer for that. Except now it hooks up to a Nintendo Game Boy. I would love to know what that whole apparatus cost.
That's crazy. I know. I mean, I don't know. I need to look this up because the Game Boy printer. And I'm curious, and I just tweeted about this. Does anyone know? I mean, did anyone actually buy this thing?
Right.
It was a thermal printer.
I know how much you love being at the cutting edge of technology.
Right.
I am amazed that you did not have the Game Boy printer.
I would love to get my hands on one of these things, though. I think I'll look great. I mean, these photos. I think this thing probably takes great photos. Screw my my Sony NEX-7 camera or my Nikon D800 for taking good photos. Like, I should have brought this to the Monkees concert to take photos instead.
Right on. Can you imagine how those would have turned out?
The Game Boy printer is compatible with all Game Boy systems.
Mm-hmm.
It was released in 1998. And it was on sale for five years till 2003.
Mm.
That is amazing. That is – because I remember – I mean there are always things with like the Nintendo – if you go to the, like the Nintendo store in Manhattan, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to. It's right like next to 30 Rock. Mm. And it's a really cool store because they've got all these like museum pieces upstairs in these glass cases of like classic Nintendo stuff. So even if you're not going there to buy a game or anything like that, if you just go on there to look at the sort of museum history portion of it, it's pretty cool. And they've got – I mean a lot of the stuff I owned, right? They had this one Game Boy that survived a fire. And because, you know, those things were pretty darn durable. And in it like there was – they have one that's like melted in some kind of a fire. And it's all melted up and the screen is a little melted. But in the little plaque says, and it still works just fine, which is pretty amazing. There's another one in there. Do you remember the robot that they used to sell – with the Nintendo NES system, the original NES system. And he was like a robot that held different like things and it was a game. Like he only had like one game. Do you remember this thing?
No.
I gotta look this thing up. And it was like you as soon as you see it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And it was here it is. It was called ROB, the Robotic Operating Buddy. And I wanted one of these. But, you know, the thing is, it turned out, like, it didn't really do anything. Like, it only, like, worked with, like, one game. I just sent it to you. It was released in 1985, and it had a really short lifespan. Their Robot Series game, Gyromite and Stack Up. Do you remember those games?
Oh, what's this you sent me here? I'm opening it now. Oh, my goodness, I do know what this is.
It was only – the thing is, like, you're like, yeah, I want that. I want that, because you'd see it in a commercial and things that. It came with the deluxe set.
You thought the robot would, like, be your friend, you know? Like, think about when this came out. This is, what, 85, right?
Yeah.
Like, we all had, like, Return of the Jedi, or maybe Jedi wasn't out yet, but at least Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, you know? Like, we all thought this was, like, R2-D2. Like, he was our friend. He'd go on adventures with us.
Right.
You know? Like, he does one thing. Or two things, Gyromite and Stack Up.
Right. And he had, like, two gloves. So you had, like, you were sort of doing the game, but then he would mimic what you were doing, I think. Mm-hmm. And they had these weird, like, little spin tops. So he'd pick them up and move them along with you. And he really, you know, but this is sort of the canonical looking robot, though, isn't he? With, like, the big eyes. It was sort of, like, right out of, what's that movie? With number five is Alive.
Short Circuit, right.
Doesn't
Who's
like
Johnny by El DeBarge on the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Who's Johnny? Man.
It says here on the Wikipedia page about this, the creation and marketing of ROB as a Trojan horse after the video game market saturation of 1983 was named the fifth in GameSpy's 25 smartest moves in gaming history. I don't understand any of that sentence.
Well, it's interesting. You know why? Because I find this to be fascinating, the North American video game crash, as it has, been coined by some. And I only learned about this a few years ago. I wasn't really aware of it, I guess, until, you know, I was older enough to, like, have some history of what unfolded with the video game crash. But it was basically a big recession in the video gaming industry that happened in 1983 because – well, I remember this. And you were always over at my house. We would play Atari games. But do you remember all those Atari cartridges I had?
Sure, of course.
Well, it seemed like you could just go down and pick them up for like 99 cents down at like the store, right? Because they were – there was just so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
There were just so many of them, and they just kept getting made and made and made. And this was the problem that Atari had. They opened up their platform in such a way that anyone could make games. And then there just became such a glut of games and a glut of crap games that it sort of led to this recession in the video game industry because there wasn't any good games anymore. And there were all of these different consoles. So you had ColecoVision, you had the Atari 520 or the 5200. You had Intellivision. Do you remember Intellivision? It was like a Mattel product. They came out with their own version.
All right, yeah.
I remember Sears had one. There were a couple of other ones too. So you had all of these consoles, and then you had Atari, which had opened up their platform, so all of these people could make games. So you had, you know, terrible titles like – and all of these quickly – it's almost like what has happened now in Silicon Valley with all these startups, right? But you had like the E.T. version, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. I remember that game. I opened that and I had that game and it was terrible. It was terrible. It was unplayable.
What did you do in that game?
I don't know. I remember there was a phone – or not a phone. There was like a – there was the – it was like the speak and spell.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to try to find like parts for it, I think, to make it work. But it never really worked, and it was just such a terribly functioning game, that it really just saturated and hurt the market. So you had all these crap games. You had ripoffs of similarly successful titles. So this is a lot of what like Apple has tried to combat in the App Store. That if you release a game that's like very similar to another game that's very successful, like Angry Birds, and you try to release like, you know, I mean, this is something they're dealing with now, like the spamming of the App Store. Like if you try to release like Angry Burps or something, you know, like something very similar, and it's just like very, very close to what Angry Birds looks like, you know, Apple won't approve it or they'll boot you out of the App Store. So this is not what Atari did. They disallowed everything. So it's very common. You could go and buy a game you thought was like the popular title and end up with the crap title. And it made parents very leery of buying any games because the kids were disappointed. They didn't want to play these things. No one wanted to play them anymore.
Okay.
And it was really bad. So this you know, you really saw like a takeoff of the computers at this time. I mean, this is like I think when, even when we ended up getting our Tandy computer. And,
the Tandy.
So, you know, people would trade them in. They were getting like the Commodore 64 at this time.
You know what people weren't getting, Clayton? The Apple IIc.
Right.
Mm-mm. People were not getting. You know that Apple IIc that I had at my house for 10 years? I think
computer.
That was, you know, I'm not as familiar with the whole timeline of Apple, but I think that was still Steve Jobs making them in his garage.
Pretty close. Well, the Apple II, you know, that's the breakthrough computer right there.
Was it? Because, man, it didn't play like it.
Oh, no, it wasn't like, you know, but it was the first computer to have like, you know, it was the first computer to have like a, you know, windowing icons, you know, and friendly environment where you could like navigate the screen. I think it's the first computer to like really use the mouse, right? It was sort of the breakthrough against the IBM, you know, the big blue of the time, you know.
I don't really remember that. I just remember that whatever I wanted to do with that computer, it didn't do. Now, it was beautifully designed, Clayton. Unfortunately, it really didn't do anything.
Wait a minute. You had the Apple IIc?
I did. Yep.
Okay, so that wasn't. I was referring to the Apple II, which was, you know.
Right.
That
I would guess the IIc would have come after that, right?
Yeah. The Apple II is the big one. The Apple IIc was like a portable one.
Yes, it even had a handle on the back, like you could pick it up and take it with you.
Yeah. So no, I mean this as it. The Apple II, of course, was the big boy. That was the 1984, you know, the famous 1984 commercial, I think. And I think the Apple IIc came out right around the same time. But the big boy was, of course, the Apple II that sort of changed everything. But I think this was like the portable one.
Yeah. Apart from the handle, this was clever design. The handle was also like the thing that stood it up. Like you bent the handle down, and it was like the legs that propped the Apple up, so that it, you know, it had a bit of a tilt toward you when you were typing. And then I don't know how well you might remember it. You know, it was like that off gray, like wasn't eggshell. What is it? Color. It had all these giant slats or slots even on the top for ventilation, and like it would give off an immense amount of heat. Like out of the top part of the computer, you know, you weren't supposed to cover that up because the computer would detonate or whatever. But you got like warm pancakes on your Apple IIc while you were attempting to play Sea Dragon or the Quest Probe Spider-Man adventure.
Yeah. No, the Apple II, the original Apple II, I didn't realize it was released in 77. Mm-hmm. It went on sale. The first Apple II went on sale. You know, the first ones were designed in Steve Jobs' garage. That was the Apple I. It's like, you know, it was like wood. This one was developed by Woz, Steve Wozniak, mostly. And I didn't realize it was that early. I thought it came a little bit later.
Now, this was before he started his band Woz Not Woz, right?
Right. Or Big Head. Then he went on to Big Head Todd and the Monsters.
Walk the dinosaur.
But this was
why
the
didn't
first
they have another hit?
This one had, you know, the first one had like speaking graphics. It had like a soundboard, so you could actually like, you know, it would actually like talk to you and the whole thing. So, anyway,
well, you went with the Tandy, yeah. Anyway, we're gonna stop and thank one of our show sponsors, Clayton. It's good that you said that. And since we're talking about high technology, you know who I was thinking we might take a moment to thank? Cobra Electronics.
Yeah, let's take a moment and thank Cobra Electronics. So I'm going to fill up a nice little hot cup of coffee here. In fact, we got the Vendetta, the new Cobra Vendetta system set up in the car.
I always want to say Vendetta.
I know. But you don't really have a Vendetta when you're using it. It's Vendetta, V-E-D-E-T-T-A, and it works amazing. I mean, it's so helpful. Today we were driving back. We were visiting the folks. We had it in the car. And, you know, you set it up ahead of time, so it already has some defaults set up that'll give you all the different radars in different states. They have all those set up. But then you can add different things, like turn on speed trap announcements, because I think that's defaulted off. So we flipped that on, right? And it helped us. We approached an area, and it just quietly says, speed trap area. I'm like, all right, let me slow down. You can certainly see where there'd be a number of speed traps along this particular area where there's a big shoulder up ahead. There's a big, there's the median in the road with like some big hills where the cops hide behind. All of those things, you know, just makes you a more aware and alert driver. When you You plug it into your cigarette lighter. You attach it nicely to your windshield. It's sleek, compact design, has a little LCD screen that flips up, works great. And when you power off the car, you don't have to worry about unplugging it or powering it off. It just turns itself off. And then when you turn the car back on, it makes a little doorbell sound, ding dong, lets you know that it's turning itself back on. And what's great too is it monitors your battery life of your car. So because it's plugged in, obviously, to your cigarette lighter, it's monitoring your battery output. And so, you know, it shows that we've got like 15 volts or whatever going through the thing, and or 14 volts. And so if that starts to drop a lot, you're noticing that's like down to 7, maybe it's time to get your battery checked so you don't wake up one morning, go out to start your car, and your car won't start, which has happened to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to mention about Cobra? I know you use the Cobra iRadar.
I do. I use their iRadar. Certainly, now you don't have much time left. You're trying to take advantage of this for the holidays, but the Cobra tag system is a great stocking stuffer. But I always like to remind people, especially because right now, like you'll see if you go into the special section on Cobra.com, like some of their most popular items. For example, one of their high-performance digital radar laser detectors, for the next week and a half, $80 off the asking price. They got a buy one, get one free going on right now on their MicroTalk CBs. So they've got tons and tons of deals, and this is where you've got to go to find them. The deep discounts, the buy one, get one free offers, and everything else. Go over to Cobra.com right now. As you're getting there, you'll see on the left-hand side of their website, it says Our Products Categories, and you'll see all the great stuff they offer, from radar detectors, GPS navigation, radios, wireless solutions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in that column, you'll see specials, and you want to check there first, because they update this all the time. There's over 36 items right now being offered as a special. Buy one, get one free, deep discounts. This is the place to do your shopping. And I believe if you hit a certain threshold, too, the shipping's even free. Definitely on some of their most popular items, it'll tell you right there. Actually, I'm going to amend that right now as I'm scrolling through these pages. All of their bestsellers, free shipping until January 3rd. So take advantage of these great, great deals going on over at Cobra.com and show them some love, because Cobra, a longstanding sponsor of the program here, and others like them, make it possible for us to deliver these fine podcasts to you week in and week out free of charge. We can't do it without them, and we'd both like to thank Cobra Electronics for their longstanding support of us here at Grizzly Productions.
Time just released their Person of the Year today.
Person of the Year, Barack Obama.
Bingo. Shocking, huh?
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, they always say Time Magazine. First of all, who cares, right? Number one, it's a magazine. Mm-hmm. But they always say, and of course this dates back, I don't know, to before World War II, whenever they started doing these things, right? They named Hitler as Person of the Year at one point during World War II. It's not people, it's not people whom necessarily are held in like high regard, like Hitler.
For their fashion, you mean.
Right. It's people who've had the most influence on the world in this particular year. And remember that year they picked, what was it, you? Or, and it was like a mirror on the front cover, and it was like a computer screen, and you look in the mirror, and it was like, this year's Person of the Year is you, because like the rise of social networks.
Wow. No, I don't remember
out.
That.
I remember that being a cop-out.
Mm. It sounds dumb.
But yeah, Person of the Year. Okay, so he gets reelected. Arguably, that's obviously a big deal.
I guess.
I mean, to me, that's just like an easy one. Like they don't even have to come into work that week. They're like, who are we going to pick this year? Is it that time of year again already? All right. I guess Barack Obama won reelection. That's an easy one. Who else? So to me, what's more interesting though is the runners up in this, because it was kind of obvious that he was going to get picked as Person of the Year, right?
I see.
Runner up. Malalia Yousafzai, I can never say her last name. She's the one that in Pakistan, the Pakistani girl, the blogger, who learned about this bombing that was intended for her father, and I guess she, I don't know,
wrote a blog about it.
Yeah, she. Malala Yousafzai, she's 15, and I guess she was one of the few. She basically she became like a child's rights advocate And because, you know, she's a child herself. And so she wanted to basically get Pakistani girls to get education. So she had been blogging about it. So she was an activist, a model student. Pretty incredible person. So she's, you know, sort of a crusade. There's like 50 million girls around the world who are don't go to school. And so she's, you know, probably going to nominate her for the Nobel Peace Prize as well. So she's doing a lot to try to get, you know, girls in the Middle East who are often told not to go to school. And, you know, certainly under the Taliban, she's been outspoken against the Taliban. The Taliban has tried to kill her, of course. They want to silence her because the Taliban doesn't want women to go to school at all. They don't want them educated in any capacity.
Now, I thought that was just rumor mongering.
It's propaganda against the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think they do enough bad things that we don't. There's propaganda doesn't need to be created in an effort to. but I thought.
Well, you know, let me say this now. I would like to. Not that I've gotten any responses to this, but when I'm done penning the one-shot comic book Skeletor's Corps of Engineers. About what it's like working for a dictator like Skeletor. I'd like maybe just like an 8-page backup story in that comic book would be like, who's the head of marketing for the Taliban? Like, I'd like to write a story about that guy.
Yeah. See if you can find that guy. Like, I mean, because it seems to me they need a better outreach. Like, mm-hmm. The Taliban's screwing things up on social media, right? First of all, if you're part of your marketing is to try to kill children, mm-hmm. That's a bad thing, right? If you're going after somebody who's trying to educate other children, that's a bad thing. You want to keep women like wearing things head to toe, so if they show the slightest bit of skin, and then you end up beating them with a stick or caning them, you're probably going to need like to hire a new PR department.
Mm.
And what PR department would take on? We got a call here on line four, Mary. Are we taking any new clients? Well, that depends on who it is. They say it's the Taliban. They're calling. Mm-hmm. They want to try to improve their image in 2013. Can we? You want to take them on? No, I'm busy. I'm busy right now. Can you send them over to Fleischman Hillard? Maybe they can.
Like, you know, I don't know enough about that because I haven't been a terrorist for very long. And
yeah, you're new to this.
Right. Yeah, I'm just getting my feet wet in the terrorism biz. Like, you have to want right, to accomplish the things that they do, or even like to make a flash mob happen, I think you'd have to be pretty organized, right? But on the other hand, like, they can't really be too organized because I think these are probably people that can't afford to be discovered by the authorities.
Yeah. Yeah, because here's like what the Taliban does as it relates to Malala, you know, who we're talking about here, the 15-year-old. Like, the Taliban was coming after her, right? So mm-hmm. She's in a school bus in Pakistan, and all of a sudden, a member of the Taliban jumps into her school bus, calls her out by name, and then shoots her in the head.
Mm.
So by all accounts, she was dead, right? No. They had to remove part of her skull. She now has a titanium plate in her head.
Woof.
So she, you know, now she's like far more of an inspirational person, not only for surviving a Taliban attack, but then speaking out for women's rights and continuing on this mission to do that. So I hope to God she's out of Pakistan. I wonder where the heck she is. I know she went to England to get medical treatment at the time. I hope she's
there's no hospitals here. You gotta go, I don't know, go to England or something.
I mean, get out of Pakistan, right? I mean,
right.
The Taliban out of food, coming to your school bus.
God. Oh yeah, them too, the Taliban. Yeah, I was thinking about how bad the food
this
is.
This is remarkable because we were talking about Doogie Howser the other day. And the reason I bring this up is because she, Malala, by the time, get this, she was 2.5 years old. She was in school in a class with 10-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
She was that smart. Mm-hmm. 2.5, that's my son's age.
Right, not smart enough to get out of Pakistan, but...
right. That's my son's age, who still wets himself, right? I mean, mm-hmm. occasionally, right? He'll have an accident here and there. 2.5, sitting in a classroom with 10-year-olds, and she can hold her own. That's Doogie Howser territory right there. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing a little Doogie Howser looking the other day online because my wife said, what a stupid premise for a show. I don't know why we brought it up. And I said, wait a second. I love that premise. It's this idea that he's, you know, he's like a childhood prodigy. He's a genius. He blows through schooling and becomes a doctor at such a young age. We were talking about this because we were in the hospital recently with our daughter, and there was a young doctor, and she thought, oh, this is going to be like Doogie Howser. And he comes in, but he was very, you know, very empathetic. He was very empathetic, very nice, very intelligent, and, you know, any questions we needed answered, he was, you know, was great about answering them for us. And then we got on the discussion about Doogie Howser, and I said, I love that idea for a show. And it, I looked it up, lasted four seasons. It's a long-running show.
Mm-hmm.
But he was still dealing with adolescence, right? So he's a kid, and you know, you always had that in every episode where, like, a patient was like, oh, are you going to send in the doctor? I don't want a kid taking care of me. And then he'd sort of wow them with his intelligence and ability.
Do you think that's kind of, like, passed out of the popular vernacular? Like, there was definitely a time when, you know, like, even at the low end of what would pass for a kid prodigy, you'd call them a Doogie Howser. Like, you think if you said that now, people would know what you're talking about?
I think of our generation, yes. But if I were to say it to,
like, your son Miles, he wouldn't know.
Right, he wouldn't know.
He'd just be like, what?
Yeah, he wouldn't know that reference. yeah. No, I certainly think that it's passed out of the vernacular. Especially because I think most people probably recognize Neil Patrick Harris now from How I Met My Mother.
And that show is dreadful.
I've never been able to get into that show.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
It's not good.
Yeah. And what's the premise? I don't get the name of the show. What's the premise? It always seems like they're just dating. Like, I don't get it. Like, what does that even mean, How I Met
right.
My Mother?
What is well, the I think, premise? I think it's like the whole series is him reflecting, right? It's like being told in the past tense. You know? Like, it's him going – he's supposedly, you know, older in life, but he's reflecting on, like, the foibles of his youth, isn't it? I swear, the only time I ever watch it is, like, when it's part of the in-flight play after a movie on a flight. And I'm like, I should just take these headphones out. I'm like, oh, I'll watch some of this.
Oh, God.
I like that Doogie Howser guy.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah. Man, comedies on CBS are, like, the worst. I know it's somehow caught on with people, but I think Big Bang Theory is, like, unwatchable. I cannot watch that show.
Yeah, and I know in the geeks circles, a lot of people like that show. I can't get into it.
Right. Yeah, because comedies have to be funny. That's one of the things.
I mean, you know, like, it was funny because, like, Seinfeld was on last night in my parents' house, and I was watching that, and it was the it was the episode where Elaine tries to put Putumayo out of business, and so she brings in Kramer with the pricing gun to try to change all the prices on all the clothes, but he steps on the pricing gun and he says, I've got plan B. It's to remove all the desiccant packets from the clothes, and these clothes won't last 5 years. So that's his whole plan. And then, you know, that's a very funny show, very funny episode. And then right after that was Big Bang Theory came on.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know that, like, Mayim Bialik, who stars in who was in Blossom,
Wait, say her name again?
No, is it not Blossom? Yeah, maybe it was not Blossom. Am I thinking the wrong person here? Mayim Bialik or the sort of dark hair?
I cannot pronounce her name. Like, I recently had to do a story about her on Daddy on Board, and I just didn't pronounce her name. I just called her Blossom because I do not know how you say her
name. But she is Blossom, though, right? I was thinking of Punky Brewster, who's Soleil Moonfry. Okay.
So, that's a great name, Soleil Moonfry.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, but she's in that show. She's in Big Bang Theory. She plays, like, a nerd with, like, big, thick black glasses on. But I can't get into it. I flipped it off right immediately.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So, anyway, so if you're curious, Blossom's getting divorced.
Yeah, she's getting divorced apparently because of – and listen to Daddy on Board because you had a good discussion about it. But this idea of – what was it? Close parenting or she believed in, like, what was it? I don't know. What's it called? You remember, don't you? The whole argument, like, her type of parenting, they think attachment parenting. They think may have led to her divorce because she held, like, basically the idea is that you're always attached to the hip with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you're always got them on you no matter what. Like, of course that's going to lead to your the dissolution of your marriage. Like, honey, you want to make love tonight? Oh, I didn't see little Mikey there attached, like, right underneath your arm. Like, of course that's going to ruin. Remember, you have to, you're married first, your parents second, you know? And then if your, like, kid is, like, always in bed with you and is, like, wrapped around you all the time, like, you don't get a date night. They don't even go on, like, date nights, right? Like with attachment parenting, like it's nonstop, child is on your back. And that's bad for the kids. They need to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
Need to get out there.
Get out of that bed.
Get out of there. Move. Anyway, the reason I brought up the Time Person of the Year, because I thought it was funny. So you've got Malala Yousafzai. I can't pronounce her last name. Barack Obama's number one. Number three on the list, Tim Cook of Apple.
Oh.
Which is interesting. I mean, I guess, you know, the company has increased, like, profit share by like 73% or something ridiculous this year. On the 1 year after Steve Jobs had passed away, the company has now, Apple is now the world's most profitable company. And so that's your list. That's your Times top three right there.
Mm. All right. I'm not going to argue with any of that. Yeah. I mean, unless – do you have like a competing person of the year that you wanted to
– No, for? I mean, if I had to pick –
You were really so strongly behind Mitt Romney. I'm surprised not to hear you come out on his back.
Mohamed Morsi is number four, president of Egypt.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What's he been up to?
Well, other than, you know, grabbing power and saying that he was going to lead this democratic transition and the United States being – hopeful that he would, and then suddenly doing this big sort of dictatorial power grab about a month ago and changing the constitution, almost becomes a dictator again, which is exactly what the Arab Spring led to, getting rid of Hosni Mubarak, the previous president of Egypt.
Hosni, oh man, yeah, I hated to see him go. Is he dead?
If you had another kid, would you name him? I was thinking about that. My wife and I were talking about this.
I name him Hosni.
Hosni.
That was, I'll tell you what, that was one and two in the running. It was going to be Elliot or Hosni. those were the top two. Yeah.
What if you named
Moonfry was number three.
Would it be racist to give a child an ethnic name? Or would it be racially sympathetic? Like if we were to give our kids, you know, a name that you would normally associate with a different race, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, would that be insensitive, or would that be sort of like you just trying to poke fun? Or I mean, would it be odd, like if our son's name is Mike and then you had Hosni as the other kid's name? Mm-hmm. Like me and what's his name? Hosni. And what's his name? Mm-hmm. Mike. Oh, okay. That's an interesting two choices of names.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's strange. I mean, I don't know if it's racist. I mean, it'd be odd.
Like if I suddenly decided, well, maybe not a race, but sort of a different ethnicity. If I were to take like the name of a, you know, like somebody from the Netherlands, you know, one of those like unpronounceable names that has like an O with a weird line through it.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Yeah. That I don't know. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what that one is.
Like if you read Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, it's like every other name in that book.
Right. Yeah, it's a Scandinavian thing, I guess. Or like, you know, that Greek, the A that's eating an E.
Right. There's our show title.
Mm-hmm.
The A that's eating the E.
You know what I'm talking about, right? Like an Aegean Sea.
Right, right. Oh, I got you. I know what you're saying. I'm picking up what you're putting down. Mm-hmm. Or if we gave our son like a Chinese name, like our next child like a Chinese name, would that be – would the Chinese be – find it racist or would they be flattered by it?
Oh, boy. I don't know.
That's a good question.
I don't know the answer,
right?
To that. Yeah. I guess we could ask all of our Chinese eggheads.
I mean this is – that's racist.
I kind of alley-ooped you on that one.
Right. I mean, this is one of the best questions you're going to hear all day. I'm glad you stopped by the cafe. What else is going on? Hey, did you see some X-Men news?
Some X-Men news?
Yeah. I guess Hugh Jackman will be on board for the next X-Men film.
Well, you know, that new X-Men film, it's Days of Future Past, but it is not X-Men 4, which they've said has been in the works for a while now. This is the sequel to X-Men First Class.
I feel like this is where Marvel is screwing up. You know, they're hitting home runs with what's going on in the Avengers universe, but they're screwing up what's going on with X-Men.
Yeah,
you have the you know, X-Men First Class, which is like the prequel. But now I saw that Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart are going to be back for another X-Men film.
Right, but that's Days of Future Past.
And what is that? Is that a prequel?
That's the sequel to X-Men First Class.
You see what I'm saying here?
Yes, it's very messy. And Mark Millar had come out and said that he believes, or I don't know if this is just his opinion or what, but that the movie that's coming out, you know, very soon, The Wolverine, it's out in 2013, happens in the same year as X-Men First Class. That they are considering that year zero for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And just the fact that, like, someone has to come out and explain that, you know?
Right.
Like, I think these two movies are happening in the same year. Like, if you can't make sense of any of this, just as a touch point here, I think these two are happening at the same time. It's messy.
Make sense. Yeah.
And, you know, Iron Man 3 now is not even 5 months away.
Wow. I saw some of the merchandising stuff get announced for that. Some of the different characters and merchandising that'll be hitting the store. I wonder if that's already out. Is it going to be out in time for Christmas?
No. I don't think that gets distribution until January. But yeah, so, man, it's a lot of stuff next year in terms of superhero films, which we talk about at length here on the program, including Iron Man 3, The Wolverine, and certainly since it's the new trailer that they cut for it has topped 20 million views on YouTube, The Man of Steel.
Yeah, so that came out since we've last spoken here on the show, and boy, does that look good.
It does look very good.
People are a little concerned, though, that it's going to be a little too gritty and dark for what we know and love about Superman, and I think this is just what Superman needs. I think.
Oh, yeah?
I think so. I like the... I think we like the big, bold primary colors of Superman and Christopher Reeve, and right, we have these great memories of that. However, that's not to say that we won't see some of that in this film. There's going to be triumphalism in this. Of course there will be. It's Superman. I think what we're seeing, though, in the trailer is sparking a lot of interest because it's the dark stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's Henry Cavill as Superman. He's floating in water at one point. Looks like, you know, he's... I don't know. It looks like he's maybe wanted to take his own life or something, or that he's floating in the water and he's just all, you know, maybe he's just contemplating or having all these like contemplative moments throughout this trailer. Mm-hmm. And it seems gritty and dark. And then, of course, you see a little flash. Do we see Zod in it or not?
In the one of them, you do. You see a brief image of Zod, and then like it's followed by, it doesn't look like it's the same scene, but like they're put together to make you think that it is. The very next clip is Superman kneeling.
That's right. And then he's got handcuffs on. I know that you guys on the trending show talked a little bit about this, and this idea of him in handcuffs has troubled some individuals. You know, why would Superman ever wear handcuffs and be subjected to some sort of, you know, unless they're sort of like, unless they are like kryptonite handcuffs. But,
I don't think that's what it is. You know, it's just the idea that, Is this going to turn into – I think people's concern, I could be wrong, is this going to turn into one of those like the military's hunting him? And I think clearly, yes. Like there's – you know what I mean? There's no two ways about it. Like you see the military surrounding Superman, and I like that sort of real-world touch. Like if a character like that suddenly appeared on the planet, like the U.S. military would show up in force.
Of course.
You know? Like there's no two ways about it. And I think – you know, Natalie described it this way, and I agree. It's that, of course, Superman would surrender himself, you know?
Right.
Like, he's not going to be like, I'm just going to fly off into space, bye-bye.
I'm going to blow up all your tanks and laugh at you and fly away.
Yeah. That's, you know.
He's gonna have a discussion. He's going to go willingly. I mean, I remember a couple of front covers of Superman back in the day where he's, you know, meeting with the president. He's doing other things that like require, you know, things that he doesn't have to do, but he does just because he's Superman. You know, he's the good guy. He's going to go willingly. He's come to our planet. We've got laws, and he's going to go and subject himself to the rule of law, and justice, of course. So it'll be interesting to see, though, how much Zod has control over the military, and maybe that's what it is, or not. But I would love to see a big blowout scene with the military trying to take on Superman. Mm-hmm. That would be fun.
Well, it might be interesting. A storyline that this kind of evoked in my imagination, or memory perhaps is what I want to say, is from the Justice League Unlimited animated series, where there's a mess up at the Justice League satellite. In the third season of the Justice League series, it's the first year where it was called Unlimited, they have like a fusion cannon in space, and it goes off, and it destroys a town. And the founding members of the Justice League, the Big Seven, decide that the right thing to do is to surrender themselves to the authorities until, you know, their guilt or innocence can be proven. And, of course, that's Superman's idea, you know? Like, that's his thing. He's the big blue Boy Scout, right? And he's the first one. He walks right up to the, you know, they surrender themselves to the military, and he presents himself to be put into handcuffs. Later, you know, of course, it's discovered that this is a diversion of things, and I think we might see the same exact thing in that, you know, the military takes Superman into custody because they want to find out, is he alien? Where do his powers come from? How do we replicate them? You know, all that kind of jazz that you imagine would go on. And in the meanwhile, Zod shows up. And Zod has all the same superpowers that Superman does, but without his sense of being a do-gooder. In Justice League Unlimited, once the people in charge realize that getting them out of the way is actually Luthor's master stroke and he and Brainiac are up to something, they have to let them out. They release the Justice League's founding members to go and deal with him. And I kind of see the same thing happening, that maybe they take Superman into custody, and while he's off the scene, Zod shows up, starts destroying everything. Because certainly there are some scenes of mass destruction that you see in the trailer, including one of like a very frightening looking spaceship that looks like it's almost about to land like outside of the Kent's house.
Right, right.
And maybe they're like, well, to deal with this guy, I guess we better let the dude in the blue tights out.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you haven't watched this trailer yet for Superman, you need to go and do it. Chances are, I bet almost all of our audience has watched it already.
Quite a few people have, as it's rapidly turning into one of the most watched videos on YouTube.
So let's take a moment here, and we got some other stuff we'll chat about on the backside of a sponsorship break.
Why don't you on tell the us backside.
On the backside. That's where I like it. I like it on the backside. Can you tell us about our good friends over at Drobo?
I will tell you about our friends over at Drobo. You know, we used to call them Data Robotics, but then they decided, hey, we're not going to be called that anymore. So it's easy to remember because this is also their website. I'm going to type it in right now. Drobo.com. Drobo.com. It's so easy to remember. And over at Drobo.com, you're going to find out about all the incredible storage arrays that they create to protect your entire digital life. I run, I can't even think, what Drobo do I have sitting here?
You have the FS, right?
That's FS.
Yeah, that's the networked one. Yeah, so all the family can jump on it.
I have an FS, because it doesn't actually say which one it is. It just says Drobo, and then there's these lights on the front that let me know that I'm about three quarters of the way full here. Inside my Drobo, I've got 4 1-terabyte drives, and here's how the Drobo works. Everything on my computer that I tell it to, it backs up redundantly across all these drives. So if the hard drive in my computer fails, I've got 4 sets of it backed up inside the Drobo. Well, what if 3 of the drives in the Drobo fail? Well, I don't have to worry because I've still got another one. What are the odds of that happening? They're pretty infinitesimal, and that's kind of the point. You know you're safe and secure when you're running a Drobo because the odds in the event of drive failure, which happens to everybody sooner or later, that you would lose all of your digital information is slim to none. I've got photos. I got the videos of my son's first steps. I've got a world of music files, all kinds of business files, every type of multimedia you can think of on here. I even have a spreadsheet where I track money on here, Clayton, and that is important for my accountant. If I lost all of this stuff, I would be up the river, but I never have to fear because I'm running a Drobo. Now, since I've had this Drobo for a couple years now, but they've continued to refine their process. They listen to what some customers have said about the Drobo, so now they make them in all kinds of sizes, like the Drobo Mini that you can pick up and take from worksite to worksite with you. They run quicker. They run more quietly. They've done all kinds of great little tweaks, added some bells and whistles as they've gone along. They make them for business. They make them for small business. They make them for personal use, and they even make them portable. And for a little while longer, our friends over at Drobo are giving some away. Can you believe that? Some of them, you might spend hundreds or maybe even thousands of dollars on some of the most sophisticated storage arrays out there. Well, you could just win one. You can't beat that. Go over and find out everything you'd ever want to know about Drobo and storage solutions, I guarantee you there's one that's right for you. And if you get lucky, you might even win one. All this and more awaits you over at great show sponsors, Drobo.com.
Christopher Nolan gave an interview this week. He sat down with like a knight. It was like a conversation with Christopher Nolan at Lincoln Center. How cool would that
have
been?
Oh, I saw the recap of that, yes.
And some of the things that came out of that I thought were interesting. Like
he talked a little bit about sweet pickles. Did you see that?
I was surprised by that. And he said the same thing about the sweet pickles lunchbox that I did, which is that it didn't hold all the books. Nolan, you and I are on the same page. Mm-hmm. He said that he was really struck by how great Liam Neeson was and how much weight he added to the words of the written word of the script. And what a great job that he did. He said he was so convincing. He even ad-libbed some parts where he tells in front of the fireplace, he tells Bruce Wayne to warm his chest because his arms would take care of themselves. Remember that from Batman Begins?
Right, when they're out on the ice.
And he says something that he was completely made up. And he was actually worried that Boy Scouts might take it seriously since Neeson was so convincing with it. Mm-hmm. And so he just like ad-libbed that phrase and thing. Some other stuff that he said he never meant for the end of Dark Knight Rises to be leave it open-ended in the way that people thought that it was a setup for another movie.
Yes.
That was one of the more interesting parts. What about you? What'd you think?
Right. I thought that was interesting. And then they also asked – I didn't see this in some of the recaps, but there was also a recent interview with his brother, Jonathan Nolan, who
right.
co-wrote the Dark Knight trilogy with him, as well as I can't think of who it is now. He helped David Goyer, where people are speculating, is it because Christian Bale didn't want to come back to do the Justice League movie that they set up an actor to take over the Batman mantle that is willing to do the Justice League movie? And that's why Levitt is set up not really as Robin, but to become Batman. And I want to say this. While that's a very interesting theory, if the Batman in the Justice League movie is not Bruce Wayne, everyone is going to be like, what?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like, that seems like such a major screw-up. I don't think that was Nolan's motivation whatsoever. But people were kind of, like, dodging that question. That seemed to come up a lot in recent interviews and things like that. And even Levitt's kind of dodged that one.
I thought that it was interesting because I don't know if you saw this, though, this week. I didn't even know this thing existed, but there's a big arena tour of Batman.
Yes, I've known about this for some time. Now, go ahead with your bit of news first, and then I'll tell you what I know.
Well, my news is that it exists. I mean, I didn't even know, that there – it has the Joker. It has, like, a full array of stunts. And doesn't – it's not like a musical, but it's
– No.
It's – maybe I liken it – what the thing that sprang to mind for me was like the Indiana Jones experience at it was formerly Disney's MGM Studios.
Yes, you're right.
And now it's
that.
What is it called now? Disney's
just Disney Hollywood Studios.
Disney's Hollywood Studios. And you know the Indiana Jones, that big stunt show, they've got the big ball rolling down, they've got the explosions, aircraft that flies in, they've got fire. That's what I thought of it as. I was like, oh, this is not a musical, is it? And it's not a musical. You've got Robin. But in the storyline, I guess, Robin is trying to seek revenge for something, and then he sort of brings, like, Batman sort of agrees to come along with him in this journey. Mm-hmm. The Joker is in it. The costuming looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any of the stunts. Have you seen anything on YouTube? And what do you know of this thing?
Yes. It's been around for a while. It toured through the UK. And then a big to-do was made about the fact that, it's coming. It's supposedly coming to the United States. And they have a very nicely put together website. There's a teaser video there that you can watch. It very much looks like the Indiana Jones stunt show meets Cirque du Soleil, and all the characters happen to be from the Batman universe. And earlier this week, all the remaining dates were canceled.
Why?
So, I don't know. I found a couple after this came out. The reason I know that is I thought my son would love to see this. If it comes to our area, like, he would love to go see something like this. So I've been kind of keeping tabs on it over the month, waiting to see They did do, I want to say, 4 North American performances. And then all of a sudden, earlier this week, everything was canceled. If you go to their website, or not even their website, you go to Ticketmaster, where they had the full tour listing, their website hasn't been updated in a while. Everything's been marked canceled. So I found a review by someone who, I think they said they were in like a giant arena and about 400 people were there. He said, the show's amazing. He said, but they barely had 400 people in a 12,000-seat arena. He's like, how can they go on? And the truth is, apparently, they can't.
Wow. That's crazy.
But they've really done a terrible job marketing it.
Well, you have to think, though, what sort of an audience it appeals to. If you've got, like, this frightening Joker, who, I mean, it looks a lot like Heath Ledger's Joker,
yes.
Which is terrifying for kids. You've got explosions, you've got, you know, he's not like the 60s Batman. I mean, he looks like almost like a sleeker version of Christopher Nolan's Batman.
Yeah, it's almost like the Nolan Batman meets the Schumacher Batman.
Yeah, exactly. And or I even go so far as to say like the Batman Begin or Batman Returns Batman that has like the at least as far as the cowl goes. But then you've got Robin in it, who looks like the Robin out of Batman and or Batman Forever. Mm-hmm. So with Val Kilmer. So I don't know how this appeals to kids. So if the parents are like, well, we can't really take our kid to see this, which is what you would usually do for an arena show, right? When you've got like a Toy Story arena show or you've got these different things, you take a kid to it. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of parents are probably thinking, we can't take our kids to it. And what are we going to have, like a theater or like an arena full of adults?
Right.
We're going to go see this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, somebody put a lot of time and money and effort into it. You know, because at the time that it was kind of rolling out, like I said, they had a slick website. This teaser video that you could watch was amazing. But, you know, somewhere, I don't know, just failed to find an audience, I guess.
One of the other things that stood out for me from that Christopher Nolan interview was about Heath Ledger, as we were talking about Heath Ledger. And I thought it was interesting that they had given him points of reference. And I love that they had given him A Clockwork Orange. Christopher Nolan had given him A Clockwork Orange as film watching reference points for what they wanted from their idea of the Joker. Now, as sort of these gallivanting villains in A Clockwork Orange. Have you ever seen that, by the way?
I never saw it.
And that's what's his name, right? Who did Eyes Wide Shut, of course.
Kubrick.
Kubrick, of course. And I mean, it's freaky. I mean, I watched it. Speaking of things you shouldn't watch as a child, I watched it as a child over at my friend Ben's house. And I remember these villains as they're going through this person's house sort of terrorizing them. In fact, I think there's that scene where he is in Bruce Wayne's house, that high rise. Looks like you could have taken that right out of A Clockwork Orange. As he's sort of, you know, going through. Well, I shouldn't say that. It almost reminds me a little bit of like the Guggenheim scene in
89 Batman.
In the 89 Batman, where they come in and they're playing the music and he's got the wand and he's going through and you have those weird henchmen who are, what are they, like dressed in kind of like tights?
The Joker's henchmen? No, they're all like in Bob the Goon gear.
Right. But that's kind of like what Clockwork Orange reminds me of. I mean, that scene where they've got these weird like cod pieces on. I'm sure you've seen imagery of it. Mm-hmm. They're like wearing tights and they have these like cod pieces on and they go to this person's house and they're sort of terrorizing them. And I could see how – I could see flashes of that or influence of that in The Dark Knight where they go into the high rise and they're sort of terrorizing them. Mm-hmm. And they're walking through and they're grabbing all the party guests and stuff. I see shades of that. But I think it's interesting, though, that they didn't give him a script. And Nolan was worried that Ledger would be influenced by the script and they didn't want to give him a script.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had been working, like, apparently Ledger was working on the Joker character for like 5 months in advance. And they didn't want to give him a script. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, did you read then about the bit where he ends up modifying one of his performances as a result?
Yeah.
And Nolan just threw it out. Like he went back and used the original version.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up because I didn't realize that there was like an IMAX prologue, like they did with The Dark Knight Rises, where they had the aircraft scene with Bane that was on the front of Mission Impossible,
mm-hmm.
Only in the IMAX. So they showed that, 7-minute scene where they're in the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that they also had one for The Dark Knight that featured the Joker.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was the bank robber scene, wasn't it?
Right. Right. So in this interview with Christopher Nolan, he says that they shot the first time they ever saw his performance of the Joker was this IMAX prologue that they shot. So they shot this thing with him as the Joker that was the first time on camera we'd seen his interpretation of the Joker. And they had a technical problem where he pulls off the mask and it's all out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
And so they reshot it. Well, Ledger, as you said, thought that he thought Christopher Nolan was unhappy with his performance because they had to reshoot it.
Right.
And so then he modified his performance of when he pulls off the mask and does some other things in that scene. And Nolan threw the whole thing out because they liked his original interpretation way better. And so in the movie, you see, and I always thought that shot looked odd. You know, and now that I know that it's out of focus,
mm-hmm.
but I just thought it was intentional. You've got this up-close, weird shot of the Joker's face when he pulls off that mask. And what does he say to him? He hands him that grenade.
Yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I know what you're talking about. I actually like the effect of it being out of focus, nevertheless. But
right, and so it just works. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's odd for a great director to use this pivotal scene that's out of focus. So, mm-hmm. And he says something about being, you know, if you don't like something or something, be smile, put a smile on your face, or mm-hmm. I don't know, something like that, right? Or
I honestly don't remember, but I know the scene what you're you know yeah. what you're referring to and stuff. And well, anyway, as it relates to what you can expect from us here, because it's getting to be about that time, I want you to know this: that it is likely this weekend you could watch Clayton on the Fox News Network.
Yeah, I'll be working straight through the holidays. By the way, so you can catch me every day.
Every day. That's right. No rest for the weary. And in the meanwhile, before we grizz again, I'll make a trending show with Natalie, and I'll make a daddy on board. And I suspect we might talk about these things when we reconvene. We may talk about the Blue Nile, I have a feeling. We may talk about the out-of-print 1990 Monkees box set Listen to the Band.
Mm.
And we might talk about the CW series Arrow.
Yeah, and we may even talk about some children of Michael Nesmith who have gone on to produce some albums. And maybe, I don't know, we had a minute or so, I wanted to squeeze that in, but I picked up Jason Nesmith's album, the son of Michael Nesmith, whom I thought we saw in concert, but it turns out that was Christian Nesmith.
Right. That's a different Nesmith.
So I bought his album Masquerade, or no, yeah, no. Shoot. Sorry, I don't have my iTunes open. The first song on it is called Masquerade.
Yeah.
Shoot, I don't have that. I'm worried I'll crash my computer if I do that. Anyway, and it's really good. I'm surprised, actually, how good it is. And then, of course, I realized that, oh, that's not the guy we saw. The front album cover of this is, and he's got some great guitar chops. But I was thinking, what, and maybe we can ponder this for next time, and we'll talk about it on the next show, but ponder this, eggheads, and tweet us about it, because I'm curious your thoughts on this. We have these expectations of what the children of our favorite artists should sound like, right? Like Sting's son. Like, there's a part of me that wants him to sound like Sting, right?
Sure, of course.
You sort of want him to carry on the legacy of this guy you love. And so when I hear, like, Christian Nesmith or Jason Nesmith, like, I want him to have, like, a similar style, but then you also want him to be original. So it must be, I mean, us as consumers, it's conflicting. I imagine being the son of a star like that must be terribly conflicting as well, because while you want to endear to your father, you also want to do something original.
Of course.
And endear to him just as well, right? I mean, so it must be this weird place for the sons of stars like this. And you had brought up, what's his name?
A.J. Croce.
Right. Who I don't think sounds anything like his father.
No. And I've heard stuff from, he's got a couple different albums. He's changed his sound a few times. Like, he never really, you know, mimics that kind of very light, you know. I mean, Jim Croce's sound to me is just an acoustic guitar accompanied by that man's voice. Like, that's the sound. And A.J. Croce, the stuff of his I've heard, has never really, you know, had that sound. But I really like A.J. Croce's stuff, nevertheless.
Right. Yeah, I mean, sounds completely different, but... You know, I think about that with the Lennon sons, like Julian Lennon. and Sean Lennon. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a part of you that wants to, you know, like, we really want him to have the same sound as John, right? He's gone. John's passed, you know, he's been killed. So we want...
Really? Did that happen to him?
Yeah. Mm. And we want to have that same sound again, you know, and can someone bring it to us? It's the same sort of thing that I think people wanted from, like, JFK Jr., right? Mm-hmm. JFK is, you know, assassinated. We want this John F. Kennedy Jr. to be this political leader that we've been waiting for, you know, to sort of fill the void that's been left by his father. So I don't know. It's just, I ponder that because I think it's an interesting point and it's an interesting thing I was grappling with while I was listening to it. It was like, I want it to be, I guess on its own, I want it to be great. But the reason I bought it was because he's his son. You know, the reason I shelled out my money for it is because he's the son of, I can't imagine that I would have bought this album, willy-nilly like that. If he wasn't related, right?
Sure, we wouldn't even know he exists.
Right. What about Dolan's? Does he have any kids that are musicians?
No. I think he has more than one child, but his only famous progeny is his daughter, Amy, I believe.
Hmm.
And she's an actress.
Hmm. Appropriate.
So, yeah, there was like a little scandal around her. I think she had, was in Playboy or something like that. I remember, like, in the 80s maybe or something like that. But other than that, yeah, I don't know anything about her.
Well, anyway. All right, my friends. Yeah, that's going to do it. Anything else?
No. We will return in about a week's time with more of a Grizz. Hey, thanks again to Drobo and to Cobra Electronics and to all of you. You can tweet us at Grizzly Bear Cafe.
Indeed. See you, my friend.
Bye.